his record is better than anybody else's, 66% a year on average for decades. No one comes close. Steve Cohen, Ray Dalio, George Soros, nobody comes close.
Welcome, I'm George Alifersi, your host, and in this episode, we're tackling the deepest question in finance, how to solve the market, with my guest, Gregory Zuckerman, an award-winning writer at the Wall Street Journal, an author of many books, including the one that interests us particularly today, The Man Who Solved Wall Street, How Jim Simons Launched the Quantrevolution. This is not just about marveling at what Jim and Renaissance technology have achieved. I'll try to find some practical lessons for investors. Gregory, thank you so much for being here.
Great to be here, George.
As it's the tradition here, I'll start with a little clip.
1245, restate my assumptions. 1. Mathematics is the language of nature. 2. Everything around us can be represented and understood through numbers. 3. If you graph the numbers of any system, patterns emerge. Therefore, there are patterns everywhere in nature. My hypothesis: within the stock market, there is a pattern as well. Right in front of me, hiding behind the numbers. Always has been. 1250, press return.
So that was beautiful, dark P or Pi by Darren Aronofsky. And it's about a loner. We can guess it's a genius, but he's not very sociable and he's trying to solve the market in his deep dark room. How different is Jim Simon from this?
Yeah, there's a lot of similarity. Jim Simons is a mathematician, so he believes in math. He believes in patterns. He believes that the market is run on certain laws of mathematics and patterns or relationships among investments, and he set out to discover them. And that was what I wrote about in my book. So yeah, there are a lot of similarities.
But what was striking in your book is that ultimately, Jim was an incredible manager. But it's worth developing more about his background, like before Renaissance technology. He's an amazing mathematician, right?
Yeah, so Jim Simons, even if he had never invested or traded a day in his life, he'd still go down in history as one of the greats in the world of mathematics, specifically geometry. He's one of the greatest geometers of the last 100 years. He got his PhD at MIT, became a teacher both at MIT and Harvard, and was a well-respected teacher, could have gone down that road and instead veered off a little bit, did code breaking for the government, but then eventually came back to academia and ran a math department at SUNY, in a really well-respected math department, I should say, at SUNY Stony Brook. He developed it, he led it, he hired people, and that was a period where he did some of his best work in the world of mathematics. So yeah, if it was just an individual who became a mathematician, end of story, he'd still go down as one of the greats. That's what's crazy about his life. He had a lot of different careers and he was very successful in all of them.
Yeah, you talked to me about one of the greats. Would we call him the GOAT in the investing world? And if he is, so obviously outstanding mathematician, but what struck me is his other qualities, what other things he brought in building Renaissance, right? It's an entrepreneurial thing, it's a managerial thing, it's a lot of other skills.
Yeah, some people have read the book and said, well, Greg, I looked for the magic formula. I didn't see that. And there isn't any magic formula. What his formula is, he does a lot of things a little better than everybody else, or a lot better than everybody else, but there's no one super formula. And part of what he does, as you kind of hint at, is manage people much better than everybody else. So it's funny that a quant is such a good manager, and that's sort of the what's so remarkable about Jim Simons. He could do both. He's a quant, he's a mathematician, he goes down as one of the greats, as I said, but he's also instinctively a really great manager. And the book, after I've written it, I realized the book is as much a management book as it is a trading or investing book. It's about how to find talent, how to recruit talent and how to manage talent. And that's kind of what he did. He brought in some of the best scientists and mathematicians from all over the world and got them to work together, which is a real feat in and of itself.
And I think that makes it so fascinating as well, the people story and things like that. So would we definitely call him, you know, you said he's one of the greatest, but in mathematics, would we call him the GOAT, like the greatest of all time in terms of investing?
I think so. His record is better than anybody else's, 66% a year on average for decades. That's before fees. After fees, it's only, I don't know, 35% because the fees are so crazy high. But 66% a year is just, no one comes close. Steve Cohen, Ray Dalio, George Soros, nobody comes close. Now, you can argue, and people have argued to me, well, Greg, he didn't manage as much money as, let's say, a Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway are much bigger, so you can't expect Warren Buffett or Berkshire Hathaway to have 66% returns a year, whereas Jim Simons' key hedge fund, it's called the Medallion Fund, was always capped for a while. It was $5 billion for many, many years. It was $10 billion. I think in recent years it got bigger, maybe around $15 billion. It's very secretive, so it's hard to tell. So you can make the argument that Jim Simons only manages $10 billion or so in that fund, so you can't compare them. And I would agree, it's two different things, but that's part of the beauty too of Jim Simons, that he decided to keep the fund small. He could have made it hundreds of billions of dollars. People would have thrown money at him, but he cared about his returns. So that's part of the calculus too. Maybe you could argue Buffett or somebody else might be better because they managed more money, but it's not like Jim Simons managed an insignificant amount of money. Again, $10 billion key hedge fund. Now it's maybe $15 billion. So that's, you know, a point of debate, just like with any sports goat, you can debate these kind of things.
Yeah, and just to push a bit more on this angle, a highly hypothetical question. Obviously, he's making over $1 billion per year, right, in his personal wealth, or something like that. But could we imagine that he would maximize even further his fortune by going, let's say, the Ray Dalio route, having an umbrella for two or 20 on hundreds of billions, so that a lot of billions as well, and perhaps even more money at the end.
So at one point, years into the firm, I think if I recall from my own book, 2010, maybe 2011, they did start some what they call outside funds, funds that are open to others. The key Medallion hedge fund is only available to Jim, family members, and people who work at the firm. Whereas these other funds are available to others on the outside. So they do manage a lot more money now. I think it's about $55 billion total if you include these outside funds. And these outside funds have done okay. Some years are good, some years are not so good. We're taping this in 2024, and it's been a very good start to the year for these outside funds. I think they're up about 5, 6, or maybe even 7% on the year. But last year was okay, not great. So these outside funds haven't done nearly as well as the key Medallion fund. And yeah, Jim could have made them even bigger. More people would have thrown money at him. Jim realized, though, that the Medallion fund, the key fund, can only manage so much money. What they do is, and we should make it clear for your audience, they're not high frequency, but they're also not traditional traders. It's called medium frequency. In other words, moments to months is their holding period, or as I say internally, seconds to seasons. It's just on average, I would argue, maybe a day or two is their holding period, but it could be even shorter than that. So again, it's not high frequency where you're in and out, zipping in milliseconds, trying to get in front of investors, but there's a limit to how much he can do. He's not also making long-term bets, like a Peter Lynch kind of thing. So as such, there's a limitation in terms of how much he can manage. And that's why he has reduced, he's minimized how much he will keep in the fund, he'll manage in the fund.
Yeah, that's what also I found so fascinating when we're looking for a formula, the magic formula. And what we learn in the book, it's that, first of all, there's this self-limitation, which is very rare, I would say, the key to the enduring success, to the track record. but also how, although it's a really a pure quant fund, there's been a lot of other factors at play, and the model has been evolved. Intuition sometimes played. There's all that, right?
Yes. It's, you know, a firm run by humans. So there are a lot of human drama as a result. And that's kind of what I wrote about in my book as much as anything. These are interesting, quirky, unusual, in some cases, personalities that he recruited. So it takes unusual personalities to produce unusual results. So there was much more drama than I expected, frankly, before I started working on the book. Thankfully, for my case, and I think for the readers, you want drama, you want to learn from people and have there be some interesting incidents. But yes, it is a reminder that these are quants, but they're quirky individuals in their own right, and they're neurotic and they're obsessive and they're competitive. So all those issues come to fore.
You know, talking about this incredible track record and enduring track record, there are so many greats in the investing world. I can talk about, well, there's Woodford, which was really falling from grace in the UK, but also maybe Bill Gross. You wrote about Paulson, and you didn't write The Greatest Trader Ever, right? It's The Greatest Trade. Mm-hmm. That's really a question about, you know, outstanding managers, elite hedge funds, etc., is their performance consistency. And one of the things that typically harm that performance is, well, they have success, they increase the size, and the performance deteriorates. Is this the price that Simon had to pay in order to, you know, keep that track record? And is it something that really differentiates him from, let's say, the rest of the investment world, where, not to be too simplistic, but everybody wants more assets under management all the time, right?
Yes, I totally agree. Jim Simons is unique in a lot of different ways. Part of it is the track record and the consistency, which I've never seen before. As you suggest, there's some people who had unbelievable years, I wrote, or periods. I wrote, like you said, my first book is called The Greatest Trade Ever, and it's about how John Paulson and some other people pulled off the 2008 trade, the subprime trade in 2009, and he made $20 billion over 2 years. No one's ever come close, George Soros. Nobody's ever come close. And you can learn a lot from that trade. And I think I did, and hopefully my readers did. The problem is, as you suggest, often these guys, John Paulson in particular, they change the way they invest after they score something, a big year like that. So John Paulson, his whole life was about limiting the downside and looking for huge upside trades. And that's what the subprime trade was. That's why they did so well in 2008, 2009. And you can read all about it there. I don't want to talk about it too much. But the problem was after they scored that huge, remarkable trade, John grew his firm. And they got to like $35 billion in assets under management. And not only that, but he changed the way he invested. He started buying things like drug stocks and bank stocks and gold with high upside, but also high downside. And that's not what made him who he was. So he got away from what his focus had been. And it happens over and over again. It makes sense. You do really well 1 year, you do remarkably well 1 year, and investors throw money at you. And how do you say no to that? It's hard. You only have yes men around you or yes women. You have nobody to tell you, hey, boss, we had a great year, but I don't think we could handle so much money. No one ever tells their boss that. You get fired or whatever, demoted. So no one was around to tell John Paulson, you know what, $36 billion is probably too much to manage here. And he thought, I've got so much money, I can hire the best people now, right? I can handle all this. And geez, I just did what I did, so I'm feeling pretty good about myself. By contrast, Jim Simons handed back money every single year. So the fund was $10 billion. And when they would make 60% on that, so let's say $6 billion, he would send checks, $6 billion to his investors, which included himself, as opposed to rolling it into the fund. And then you get a management fee on that fund and keeping it big and growing it, etc. So I don't know. Yeah, he determined that their algorithms, their signals would only produce X amount of profits and no more than that. And beyond that, they're watering it down. And to his credit, he stuck with that.
Yeah, and that's where I also think there's a part of what I found fascinating is obviously we talk about the heroes, we talk about the managers, the Paulsons, the Simons, but I think isn't there as well like an organizational intelligence as opposed to just the individual intelligence, because it's never one man and the screen, right? What I discovered there is that, well, there's so much about it, there's tweaking, and I guess the algorithm, you tell the tale of how it's evolving over time, and that's what really people focus on.
Yeah, so as a writer, you focus usually on the criticisms of your work, not on the compliments. So one of the criticisms of my book, The Man Who Solved the Market, is that, well, Greg, it's not the man, it's the men, and once in a while, a woman. In other words, it was a whole team. And I write about half my book is about others, I would say. Only about half the book is about Jim, maybe even less. And I think that's a good critique. I could have said the man, but Jim is the fascinating individual, most fascinating. Oh, there's some other interesting ones. But yeah, it's a team effort. And frankly, it also speaks to or good fortune, meaning some of these people he hired, I mean, Jim gets credit for hiring them, but they came up with the brilliant ideas on their own without Jim's input. Sometimes Jim wasn't even around. He was doing other kinds of things. So I write about that. So yeah, it's exactly right. It's really a team effort, as any big accomplishment is. I mean, I wrote a book about science, and my last book was called A Shot to Save the World. It's about how we developed the COVID vaccines. And once again, you kind of expect it to be some genius in a laboratory, and then you see it's really just a series of different people who make incremental advances. And the same thing with Simons and Renaissance. They, for years, couldn't figure out how to trade equities or make money in equities. And it took a few people who came from IBM, Bob Mercer, Peter Brown, this guy David Magerman. And Magerman found a glitch in the system. One guy found a glitch in the system and went to his boss, Bob Mercer, and said, "Hey, boss, I think there's a mistake here. I think this number isn't updating. It's a static number." And his boss said, "You know, you're right. We messed that up." So it takes a lot of individuals.
I think what I'm trying to find the lessons for investors as well is, and I think very often the manager is the hero. There's a star, and it doesn't last. There's this performance consistency benefit. But again, what I see here, you know, this organization where someone, a newcomer, can tell to the boss, "Hey, there's a mistake." He might get fired in many organizations. So, you know, it could be a very hard conversation that will take time, etc. So I find that as well is kind of an enduring lesson from the book.
So, again, I find a lot of, after I've written it, there are a lot of managerial and organizational lessons. And one of them is the importance of working together and having a flat organization. That's what Renaissance is, and that's what Jim always emphasized. So Jim does get a lot of credit for that. He built that organization and the structure, and it's very flat. Everyone, it's an open architecture. People know what everyone else is working on. It's crazy like that. Even junior people can see their secret sauce, as it were, their code, and work on it and improve it, and everyone has an incentive to even incrementally improve, and they have one model as opposed to most firms have a million trading models. So there are a lot of lessons from just how the organization is structured, I believe.
Wonderful. Now I want to move on, if you allow me, to this quant revolution and where we're at today. And I'll start by another little clip, this time for the series Billions.
Quant is just another word for wild fucking guess. With math.
Quant is another word for systemized ordered thinking represented in an algorithmic approach to trading.
I don't know if you're familiar with Billion, but two very contrasting views of quants.
So I'm a storyteller. So inherently, my instincts are to tell stories and about people and to use instinct and intuition. And from my work on this book, I've become a convert, a believer in the quant approach to life. It's not to say that you hand all decisions over to systems. But as much as you can, if you can systematize decision making, I've become a believer because of all the behavioral decisions, the behavioral mistakes. Behavioral economics has influenced me and others, and we've learned how many dumb mistakes we can make as investors, but as humans too. And frankly, all kinds of decisions in life have been systematized. So a pilot before takes off, it's an individual making decisions, granted, but he's got a checklist or she's got a checklist now, and surgeons too. And we're moving over. AI is going to be helping in terms of drug development and helping doctors decipher challenging diagnoses, et cetera. And I'm a true believer, and it's actually crazy to me that some of the biggest decisions in our lives by the presidents of the United States, let's say, and Federal Reserve, et cetera, are still people kind of winging it and using their intuition and judgment, trying to get it right, as opposed to systematizing it to where you can. I'm a believer in man plus machine. So doesn't mean, again, you hand everything over, but yeah, they make fewer mistakes and they don't panic. They don't get greedy as much as we do. And they don't wake up on the wrong side of the bed and have it affect them. So I have become a bigger believer in the quant approach. It's not to say that quant investors always beat individual investors. I know, but at the margin, I think they do a better job. They're cheaper. And they and frankly, you know, I blame myself to some extent because I spent a career, been at the Wall Street Journal 27 years now, and I write about home runs and strikeouts, individuals who came out with some great idea and made a fortune or lost a fortune. And there's a lot of drama with those, a lot of lessons. And there are people, and I'm writing a new book, which focuses on some of those kinds of people, Soros and Druckenmiller and Buffett and Munger and some of the classic investments. And I think they're brilliant and there are a lot of lessons involved, but can you and I do what they do, or is it better to hand the decisions over to machines? More often than not, I have become a believer in the quant approach.
I've got a few questions about where we are in quants today, but just because you mentioned this and because I watch a lot of those clips, I try to talk about quants, but what I see is that typically they talk about it a little bit, but they fail to show the quant because it's really hard to show it. It's not very visual. It's not very storytelling. So I was curious, how do you talk about quant as a writer?
Yeah, George, it's a great question, and it kept me up nights. How am I going to write about a quant firm in a way that people will care about and want to read and turn the page? It's a huge challenge. It's part of the reason why no one's made a movie of my book, I think. There is an inherent challenge there. So the way I came at it is through the people, and they were much, much, much more compelling and interesting and complex than I had expected. And that is kind of the challenge for the storyteller. How do you tell a story about numbers, basically, and algorithms, signals? But another one of the criticisms of my book, and this is one that I can make, is that I focus a lot on the drama within the firm. And the few times when Jim Simons and others tell the machines, put the machines on pause and step in and interfere with their quantitative approach. And it did happen. It's all truthful. It's all accurate. But you come away with the impression, perhaps, that they sometimes get away from their approach and mess around with their systems. And again, it does happen, but it's very infrequent. So I wrote about the dramatic examples, the dramatic exceptions to the rule. But more often than not, and especially since Jim is not there running things day to day, and it's Peter Brown, they are true to their systems and they let their systems trade for them, and they're doing work behind the scenes. It's just that, yeah, you don't write a book about write an article about the plane that lands safely. You write about the crash, unfortunately. So I write about the drama within the firm, and it's all accurate and all was really important and compelling. They made a ton, and then they were at each other's throats and almost broke apart in two, and it's all accurate. But I also don't want people to come away the impression that they're just sometimes turning off the system and trading. That happens once in a really blue moon, kind of a black swan kind of thing.
Yeah, no, I totally understand. And I think, like, I can't compare, but I'm trying as well to use a bit of a pop culture to explain investment facts, or take the investment facts and separate the fictional aspects. And the fact that we can follow the story is teaching us a lot about quants, even if we come for the story. So I'm really very grateful for the book, because this has been my, you know, I discovered this universe through this. And like you said, there isn't much else. But you also started earlier by calling it medium frequency. And I'd be very interested to know a little bit about where we are in this quant revolution today, kind of what's the landscape.
So in some ways, Wall Street has embraced it, and it's been a revolution. The majority of trading is automated. It's not picking up the phone and calling someone anymore. Even the bond market has changed. And there are major firms besides Renaissance, obviously, that rely on a quant approach, Two Sigma, sometimes others kind of less or more than other times, but a lot of firms rely on the quant approach. So yeah, it is dominating trading today. The question is, a lot of it is execution. So a lot of trading, in other words, the decision has been made by someone, sometimes an individual, but the actual trade is executed with a quant approach. It is the system decides when to put the trade on, where, how, what size, etc., which is great. But in terms of the decision to make the trade, it's not always done with a quant approach. Sometimes it is, sometimes not. And there's some firms that are seen as sort of quanty, like Bridgewater, which aren't really. That gets overstated to some extent. They're maybe systematized. That's not even clear. My colleague, former colleague, Rob Copeland, wrote his own book that showed that they're not as systematized as you might think at Bridgewater. So there aren't as many firms doing what Renaissance is doing. And that's part of the reason why they've done so well. In what they do, medium frequency trading, there really aren't as many rivals as you might expect. But yeah, in general, people have come around to the view that you need quants. And everybody's got some quanty aspect to their firm, everybody. And when you go on a tour of a Wall Street firm, they're like, Greg, over there are our PhDs in that corner, and they're working on a quant approach. And part of it is marketing, so you can tell your customers, etc. But part of it is people have embraced the idea that you need some systematized approach. And again, it's ironic and disappointing to me that the average investment firm realizes they need to be systematized. But again, the President of the United States and the Federal Reserve, those guys aren't nearly as systematized.
If I understand well, we kind of live in a quant world. I mean, everybody has some tools, even private investors. But it's really a spectrum, and I would say Renaissance is the top of this spectrum in terms of mathematical automate. And then there's a whole area. And you mentioned Bridgewater, which is somewhere at the top, but not at the very top. Is that a way to see this quant? In my mind, my simple mind, I was going to say, systematic arbitrage and factor. And that's quant.
So factor investing is a form of quant investing. It's not all automated. Factor investing is more doing what we've kind of always done, let's say growth investing or value, but in a systematized way, an automated way, which is a form of quant. It's just different from what Jim Simons does. They look for relationships, hidden relationships among investments and patterns, hidden patterns. That's not what some of these firms do. And then you have some firms, let's say D.E. Shaw, which people kind of see as a quant firm. Mm-hmm. They do some quant, but they also have some non-quants there as well. So it's more complicated than one might think.
And yeah, talking back to what you say, can the president or can we have a more systematic and quant approach? How we would take our first step towards that? How can our life be improved as an investor or in another way?
That's a great question. So Michael Bloomberg, when he was mayor of New York City, he embraced a more systematized approach. And a lot of it is data and looking at past decisions that look similar to those you're about to make and letting that inform your decision. And again, it doesn't have to mean turning all the decisions over to the computers, but you could do that, or you could just make sure that you're using every kind of piece of data possible. And there's some system, there's some approach that you're doing over and over again. Okay, so you're making an decision. You're a pilot, you're a surgeon. You're about to go and do something really important. Make sure there's some consistency there. And you've got a checklist, as it were. And investors can do that too. I've made these mistakes in the past. I'm aware of them. Here's a similar kind of decision. Let's go through the pattern I did before. Let's go try to take a step back and see if I've checked all the boxes this time as well. Maybe it means having more data and inputting data, using different kinds of data. And that's what Renaissance, they're all about, just gobbling up. You're a vacuum of every kind of piece of data. They call it alternative data today. But if you can come up with a piece of data, they've purchased it and they've scrutinized it and they've seen, is there some relevancy to this data, to what we do? They do trading, they do investing. Is it relevant to them? But you know, we all can, in our own ways, be aware of data and past information and use it to inform our decision-making. So when it comes to, let's say, AI and doctors, I mean, doctors, when they diagnose, it's all based on their past diagnoses, what they've read in literature about other people who made similar diagnoses based on similar evidence. And I can easily see that being handed over to machines, to AI. And AI, frankly, is just a form of quant. I mean, Jim Simons was doing AI back in the 1980s. They were doing machine learning. That's the whole point. Looking at patterns, having it find patterns, having the machines find patterns that you're not aware of, that the human eye just can't pick up, or our intuition can't deduce. So AI is a form of quant, and I'm a big believer when there are decisions that are made repeatedly in drivers, you know, AI automated driving, those are just repeated decisions based on your intuition, your judgment. When I go and drive later today and get in the car, it's all kind of making repeated decisions based on what I've done in the past and my judgment about the future. And I would frankly trust an automated automobile AI better than my own judgment. I'm a good driver, but I don't have as many decisions that I can rely on in the past that are similar as a system could. So those kinds of things, I think, are ways to embrace the quant approach in one's life.
Great. That brings two last questions. The first is, as you mentioned, data. And one part of the book is how someone went on a data recovery, right? They're really trying to piece together the missing data. And so important. And I think today, everybody, if you say we are data driven, right? I mean, all firms say they are, but ultimately it's not about, oh, okay, we press a button and we process the thing and that we get an answer. This data and eventually history is so important. And I think that's also something that was very crucial in the history of Renaissance, finding the data, building the data set.
Yeah, so that's one more accomplishment, achievement that you can say wasn't Jim Simons. He hired a guy, Sanford Strauss, who took it upon himself to not only just acquire every piece of data they could. We're talking about gold prices going back to the 1700s at the Federal Reserve and painstakingly writing them down. He cleaned the data, realized that some of this data is not clean. It could be some aberration. Someone could have made a mistake. He checked it all. And that wasn't Jim telling him to do so. He gets the credit. He was the first kind of data engineer, maybe, or something, and like in the 1980s. So that was a huge advantage for Renaissance and the Medallion Fund for many years. They had, and they still have, better data than everybody else. Now, it's not as much of an advantage. Today, it's much easier to get clean, accurate, extensive data. So they don't have as much of an advantage. They do have some cool stuff going back centuries that maybe other people don't have. But yeah, that embrace of the data and this religious adherence to the practice of turning the decisions over to the computers and letting them decide based on the data. Once you've got the best data, then you can make the best decisions is the idea. And they were really early. They were pioneers in so many different ways. This importance of data, which everyone realizes today in society, but they were decades ahead of everybody else.
Wonderful. And to bring it back to the current hype about AI, from what you tell me, again, it's a continuation. We talk about a lot AI in financial services, but there's nothing fundamental from what they were doing many years ago, and it's going to keep evolving. And I'm sure Renaissance is tweaking their models to find the next edge, maybe getting the new set of alternative data.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wrote a piece for the Wall Street Journal after the whole ChatGPT hysteria began, or hoopla, and I wrote about how all of society, or most of society, is embracing and coming around to AI and learning about it, some people for the first time. But on Wall Street and at Renaissance, they've been doing this for decades. And frankly, they've come to the realization that the best approach often is, not always, often is man plus machine. So as opposed to turning everything over to AI, they actually think you could do better having some individual involved. With Renaissance, it's more machine plus man as opposed to man plus machine. So the machines are the dominant players there and often come up with trades, make trades without the people even realizing why they're doing it. But they do figure out afterwards, or they try to figure out afterwards, and they'll decide whether to put more money or less money on those trades sometimes. So there is a still component of the individual, the human. And yeah, I talked to the people at Renaissance after ChatGPT came out, and they were intrigued by that and all that, but it wasn't affecting how they do their job. So it has actually much less of an impact. This AI revolution all of a sudden in the past year is having less of an impact than you would expect at a firm like Renaissance or on Wall Street in general. Yes, they are embracing it and turning more decisions over to systems and quants, but they were doing that anyway.
Gregory, thank you so much. You provided many criticism of your book, but it's an amazing book. For anyone who's interested in quant, you know, this is the ultimate resource. And in any case, to me, it's such a book about investing, life, star investor, performance, consistency, all the questions that someone needs to ask himself herself if you want to invest seriously. And here we see it through the detail of people, and that's what makes it so unique. So I'm very grateful about that, your participation, the book. I'm very excited about what's coming next. So we'll be following that very eagerly. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And I'm love to be in touch with your audience. If people have questions, they want to reach out, I'm easy to find, LinkedIn and Twitter and email. So I'm looking forward to having some interaction if people want that.
We'll be sure to put all the links in the description of the podcast and the YouTube video. So guys, please check it out. Thank you for your time.